and computer science. He's interested in all areas of applied mathematics, most recently in finance and optimization, and in practical problems that lead to interesting math. Agnès Touraine grew up in Paris, France, where she was educated at the École des Mines. She did her PhD and subsequently held a faculty position in the University of Paris Dauphine, one of the world's centers for financial decision making. She came to Toronto about 5 years ago and currently is an associate professor of mathematics at McMaster University. She is an expert on Hamilton-Jacobi equations and non-smooth solutions. Please welcome Robert and Agnès to the podium, who will speak today on the mathematics of glider racing.
That should be working.
Great, thank you very much. It's really really an honor to be here. This is, I think, 150 years of continuous Sunday lectures. There are essentially no interruptions. As you said, this is a joint project between both of us on mathematics of glider racing, supported by NSERC. Both of us had NSERC research grants. So let me begin with a preamble, sort of saying that this is a project in applied mathematics, and loosely speaking, applied mathematics is modeling plus mathematics. And to set the stage, let me give you one of my favorite quotes. It's a very famous quote from a guy named Joseph Fourier. So at the end of the 18th century and the beginning of the 19th century, Joseph Fourier was a French engineer, which meant essentially a mathematician, and he was interested in studying heat flow in solid bars. And in particular, he was interested in describing the distribution of heat when the initial data was discontinuous, so it was cold on one side and hot on the other. And he constructed a solution using sort of ad hoc methods of mathematics, which were very controversial because solutions were non-smooth and were not able to be studied by the mathematics that existed at that time. But because of his insistence on studying non-smooth solutions, it essentially was the impetus for the development of analysis and the development of mathematics that could describe these kind of solutions. And that impetus lasted essentially through the 19th century and eventually led to the study of functions that have derivatives nowhere, which underlie the entire modern economy. So the quote says, when he wrote this up in his lengthy paper about the analytical theory of heat, he says, "The profound study of nature is the most fertile source of mathematical discovery." So that's our point of view here, is that you find good mathematics by finding good problems outside mathematics in nature. And he says, "Not only does this study offers researchers a determined goal, has the advantage of excluding vague questions and calculations with no exit, it's also a certain way to form analysis itself and define the elements that this study should always keep in mind and that this science should always conserve. These fundamental elements are those which reproduce themselves in all natural effects." So our goal, in general, and in the particular example I'll show you, is to find a particular problem, particular phenomenon. And so the goal is, by doing this analysis, first of all, to say something interesting about the particular problem, and then, in general, to extract general mathematical principles that can be applied in other problems which may not appear similar in their physical description but have similar mathematics. So the particular example that we're talking about today, we'll do it in two steps. The first step is about the modeling. So that's where you take a problem that's out in the physical world and you construct some mathematics that describes it, and then the second part is the mathematics that you use to solve the problem that you constructed in the first part. And I'll sort of summarize the important themes of the whole talk. Of the first part, the theme of the modeling is general theme of decision making under uncertainty. I'll summarize that a little bit more in just a moment, but making decisions when you're uncertain about what's going to happen in the future. The particular example is glider racing, which may sound like a trivial, frivolous example, but I'll hope to convince you that it poses some interesting questions. And then the main challenge when you construct the mathematics from the model is, how do you describe the degree of information you have? So the future is not completely uncertain, neither is it completely known. So how do you capture that in a mathematical model? And then Agnès will talk more about the mathematics, but let me just summarize to advertise in advance. The difficulty is, just like Fourier, the solutions are not smooth. There's a mathematical technique, which is the theory of viscosity solutions, which was developed by facing similar mathematical difficulties in a very wide range of physical problems. And then she'll talk about what this problem has in common with many other physical problems. So just to sort of say a few words about the general problem of decision-making. Oops, it's not looking pretty pictures yet. Decision-making under uncertainty. the area of human activity where this is most widely developed is finance in general. All kinds of finance and investments, the problems there are essentially defined by the fact that you don't know what the future is going to be. So future motions in the market are uncertain, yet you have to make investment decisions today. Now, there's a distinguishing feature of these types of finance problems. It's the principle of the efficient market, which says that, to the extent it's true, which is pretty well true, is that the future is completely uncertain. So any information that anyone has is already incorporated in the price. So you there's a very strong separation between the present and the future, complete lack of knowledge. Now, there are other classes of problems, and to me they're appealing because they're sort of physical, so you can describe in physical terms what you're looking at. They're not sort of abstract. And the ones that I have the most experience with are racing of sailboats and gliders, things that depend on atmospheric conditions which are uncertain. And in both of these, just as in financial investment, you win, or you win your race, just as you make money here, by correctly anticipating what the wind is going to do or what the convective motion of the atmosphere is. But the difference, and the reason, well, one of the differences, the thing that makes these problems somewhat more challenging than finance, is that you have partial information. So that's one of the things I want to show you. You look out, you know, up the race course of your sailboat or your glider, and you can see something about what's going to happen, but it's not certain. All right, so let's talk about gliders. So, not talking about hang gliders, we're talking about aircraft that look like this, typically single place, although there are two-place ones for learning. Wingspan is 15 meters exactly, because that's the rule. There's a racing rule that the 15-meter class can have a wingspan maximum 15 meters. They're made of fiberglass and sometimes carbon fiber. And mechanically, these kind of aircraft are very simple. So there's basically a fiberglass shell, three or four different flight controls, and that's about it. There's no motor, and there's really not much that goes on. Aerodynamically, they're extremely sophisticated. So the shape of the fuselage, and especially the shape of the wings, is very carefully constructed so that this is an extraordinarily efficient flying machine. And the way to tell you how efficient it is that the drag force pushing back on it is typically about 1/40th of the weight of the aircraft. It is the lift generated by the wings. That means that when the thing is gliding, for each 1 foot of altitude that it uses, it can glide 40 feet horizontally. Or to put it another way, if you were to start this thing at the top of the CN Tower, it could glide about 14 miles with that amount of altitude. So there's no other aircraft in the air that has similar degree of aerodynamic efficiency. The way it gets into the air, since it has no motor, it gets pulled up by an airplane, towed by a tug like that. And then once it's up, it releases, and then you have the freedom of the whole sky. You can go anywhere you want. You don't have to follow the wind. It's not like a balloon. I mean, you can really point it anywhere you want to go. And then the way you stay up, at least around here where you're away from the mountains, is convection in the atmosphere. So what happens is nice cool air comes in after a cold front. The sun heats the ground, makes a warm patch on the ground, eventually heats more and more, generates a bubble of warm air. That bubble breaks loose from the ground and rises up. And then when it rises to the altitude at which it's cooled enough so that the water condenses and it forms the puffy cumulus clouds, which we're familiar with on nice summer and spring days. So you can think of this, there's sort of a bunch of oversimplified ways to think of it, either as a bubble of warm air, or more typically in practice, we tend to think of it as columns of rising air, looking like that, there you can actually see it rising, that rise from the ground and then end in a cumulus cloud. And so if the weather is such that there is this condensation, the clouds are good markers of where the thermals are. They're not perfect, but they give you some information. And then the way that you fly, the way that you stay up, is to climb up, you fly in circles within the column of rising air. So of course the aircraft is descending relative to the air, but if you keep it in the air that's going up, you can climb. And this is, of course, the pictures on that, the diagrams on the previous page are a tremendous simplification of something that's actually very complicated. Here's some empirical studies. Some Germans measured the vertical speed within one of these thermals, and you can see that there's a very complicated structure. So there are regions of very strong lift, and then several different bubbles, and then it typically goes down around the outside. And a different sort of schematic of how most people would understand what goes on is that somewhere at the bottom there are sort of multiple bubbles of warm air that coalesce and form a column of rising air. So it's not totally absurd to think of this as a coherent structure. There are bubbles that they condense, and then all kinds of aircraft can and do their stuff in the column. And then at the top, it sort of spreads out and eventually comes down around the outside. And so what you see when you look, when you're at altitude, you look out across the landscape, and you can see you're probably looking 50 miles in this picture, so you can see the clouds. Here you're at the height of the clouds, so you can sort of see the clouds. Each cloud is the marker of a top of rising air, and you can also see the shadows on the ground, so you have some information, but you can't see perfectly well, but you can see something. And just to emphasize again the scale, there's a rule that if you can see something, you can glide through it. So from where this picture is taken, the person flying this aircraft can probably reach, without stopping to circle at all, can go to the farthest distance that's visible in this picture. Distances and speeds are very long. So the way you travel cross country is that you travel from cloud to cloud. So you glide here, you find a column of rising air, you circle, you go up, then you glide over here, and you get lower, of course, and you glide, and you climb some more, and you hear you found a bunch that are sort of in a row, so you can climb and stay up. So you basically, these things are spread out across the countryside, you can follow them around. And then here's another picture of the same thing, again with a nice schematic, cylindrical thermal. So you circle, you climb up in the spiral, climb up in the column of rising air, you glide to the next one, and you climb up, and then you glide to the next one, and that's all great. And then once in a while, it happens that you set off from the top of your thermal, and there just your information was wrong, or you're just out of luck, and there just doesn't happen to be a thermal that you can reach before you run out of altitude. And when that happens, you land in a field, lots of fields, usually bigger than the airports, and then somebody drives out with the trailer and picks you up. So that's a normal, landing on the ground is a normal activity. It's a normal thing you have to take account of. Now, here's a picture of the inside of a glider, and what I want to point out is that you typically have, these things carry fairly powerful computers. So these two instruments that I'm pointing to are computers, and they integrate information from the flight instruments and GPS and anything else that's available, and they help the pilot make decisions about whether he should stop and circle, whether he should glide, how fast he should fly, all kinds of stuff. So that's one of the incentives for doing mathematical modeling, is that you can implement it. And these are fairly powerful computers. Then one of the fun things to do is competition. So everybody gets together, brings their glider all to the same place, bring their family, bring their pets too, and then typically, the rules are typically very complicated, but it's not too much of a simplification to say that what you do in a competition is there's a specific course that's set, and then everybody flies around the course and tries to do it as fast as possible. So here, for example, is a trace. And this is the actual, this is the X and Y, so this is longitude and latitude, from the 2001 Canadian National Competitions that were held at my club, the Soaring Association of Southern Ontario, out in Rockton, Ontario, which is west of here, just south of Cambridge. And so on this particular, and the trace is, of course, from the GPS. It's recorded by the flight computer and analyzed afterwards. So the course started at Rockton Airport, that's the home base. There was a first turn point at Tillsonburg, then over here to Waterford, then up to New Hamburg, and then back to Rockton. So the race on that day was to go around these four points, well, around these three, and then come back home. And if you look, what I've done is here, take the same data as before, and I've essentially unrolled it. So the x-axis here is the distance remaining from the finish. And the distance, let me emphasize, you can go really far distances. 350 kilometers was the distance that this guy went in a time of a couple of hours. And so, as I say, I've unrolled it so those axes are unfolded on the straight line. So here's the first leg, Rockton to Tillsonburg, Tillsonburg to Waterford, Waterford to New Hamburg, and then back home to Rockton. And what you can see, it's a little bit difficult because the scale is so compressed, but this is a graph of altitude, so it's altitude versus distance. What you can see is periods of gliding, so gliding forward, where he goes down and trades altitude for distance, interspersed with periods of climb, where he goes up vertically without advancing toward the goal. So basically, as I say, the characteristic pattern here is the sawtooth with slopes here and then vertical lines going up. And occasionally, at sometimes he gets lower than at others. So basically, he's staying within a certain altitude band. Once in a while, he gets unlucky. He doesn't find what he needs, and he winds up low, and then he climbs back up. And then here, actually, he wound up going backwards because he actually almost landed. He's only about 700 meters above the ground, which is really, since this is altitude above ground, that's about the minimum before he would have to land. But he got lucky and just caught something and climbed back up and completed. So the reason, so what's the argument why you should do math modeling for these problems? First of all, the distances, as I showed you from that picture, the distances are very far. In hundreds of kilometers, the angles of glide, 40 to 1, are so fine that your own intuition and your own eyesight is not good enough to tell you what you should do. It's just too, the decisions are too delicate. It's very important to fly fast, even if you're not in a competition. If you're just going out for fun to fly 300 kilometers, you have to be able to complete the course and get home before the end of the day. So you're always thinking about speed. Also, the computers are available. So the aircraft carry computers. It's not like, say, a running sport where you're, or a bicycle. You know, a bicycle doesn't carry a computer. Gliders do carry computers. And then there's a history, maybe because the sport tends to be done by sort of geeky engineer types, there's a history, it's short, I'll essentially give you all the history of quantitative modeling. So there's a history of mathematics being involved with the sport of soaring. So that said, let me give you some examples of sort of what the history of quantitative modeling is in this area. The most famous result is by from a guy named Paul McCready. Paul McCready was an aeronautical engineer, and in the 1950s he was very interested in glider racing, and he considered the following issue. Here you are, you're leaving the top of a thermal, and what you see out ahead is you see a couple of weak thermals. So there's weak ones here where you can climb, but very slowly. But further out ahead is a strong thermal. So you know that if you can get there, you'll be able to climb very fast. And so you have to make a decision. The decision you have to make in choosing your strategy is twofold. First of all, should you stop, this black line here, should you stop and spend time climbing in the weak thermal? The answer is no, because if you do, you'll spend a lot of time climbing up very slowly, and the guy who lasted right through the weak thermal and went ahead to the strong thermal will climb back up faster and be again at the end here sooner than you are. So you have to decide what will you accept, and then the second decision you have to make is what speed will you fly? Otherwise put what is your angle? So you can fly faster horizontal speed by accepting more of an altitude loss. So if you go down, what happened here, this guy B went at the maximum slope, but he flew slowly and he gets overtaken by the guy C, who flew faster, got to the thermal faster at a lower altitude, but was able to climb and back up and make it back up. On the other hand, if he takes that to too much of an extreme, D here, you wind up on the ground. And what he said, what he calculated, it doesn't matter what the details are, but let me just say that there's a very simple calculation. This is sort of the only quantitative thing I'll show you. You draw a graph of the aircraft performance, which is very well known, easy to measure, and there's a simple construction by drawing a tangent to this curve, and it gives you the McCready construction. The result of this is a number called M, the McCready value, and that's the input is, what you have to put in, is the strength of the next thermal that you'll find. So you have to put in what you think you'll find out ahead. Once, if you know that, it tells you two things. It tells you when you should stop, when you should keep going, and then it also tells you how fast you should fly in between. So if you're flying through air that's moving up and down, it tells you how to control. And this algorithm, this McCready value, is actually implemented in the computers that everybody carries. This is a picture of an actual flight computers. What I want to point out is this knob here, which is labeled SPF, that's speed to fly, that's the McCready value. So literally, you sit there and you turn this knob. It doesn't tell you what value you should put, but you put in that value. And then the other display here tells you whether you're flying too fast or too slowly. So it's doing the calculation that McCready did, that McCready figured out. And that's a pretty standard thing. Everybody has this. And by the way, McCready won the 1955 world champion because of this great discovery, and then he published a paper explaining how to do it. So there have been a small number of published articles on the subject. Let me cite two. I'm going to cite two, and then I'll talk about our paper. Anthony Edwards, a British probabilist, also a glider pilot, wrote an article in British soaring magazine, Sailplane and Gliding, and he was, as far as I can tell, the first person to introduce the idea of randomness into glider flying. So stochastic means random. What does stochastic mean? It means there's an element of chance you may not reach your goal. So, old-fashioned language, much is known about stochastic processes. I want to introduce them to gliding in a simple example. And so one of the themes of the talk is that you have to make a mathematical model. So before you can use what's known about stochastic processes, you have to say what the randomness is. And for his paper, he made a very specific model of the randomness. What he said is he said all the thermals are the same strength, they all go up at the same strength, but the distance from one to the next is a random variable. So when you set off, you simply don't know how far you'll have to go. And under that assumption, I mean, you can think it's a good assumption or a bad assumption, but under that assumption, he solved the problem, and he constructed what he calls the efficient frontier of optimal soaring, and that's a wonderful term because efficient frontiers are very well known in investment. And what an efficient frontier always plots in some way or another is on one axis it plots the quantity you're trying to maximize, which here is speed. In investment, it would be return, it would be expected return. And on the other axis plots something to do with the randomness. For financial investment, it would be volatility. And here it's the probability of being able to complete your flight before you land on the ground. And then what you do is you look at this part of the curve as a set of values you can achieve. And what he points out is that this value right here, which is 55 knots, has the maximum average speed. So it's the furthest to the right on this picture. That's the quote, McCready speed. That's what classical theory would say. But at that speed, with his parameters, you only have a 40% chance of completing your flight and not landing in the field. If you decrease your speed only a little bit, your average speed goes down only a little bit. So as you move up this curve, you move to the left only a tiny amount, but you dramatically increase your probability of arrival. So if you're up at the top here, flying an average 45 miles an hour, you have almost a 60% chance of completing, and your average speed is only a little bit less. The next, the one other article that we want to cite is from a guy named John Cochran. He wrote an article named McCready Theory with Uncertain Lift and Limited Altitude. This appeared in a journal called Technical Soaring. Very appropriate. And I also want to point out that John is a professor of finance at the University of Chicago Graduate School of Business. So this is an area that attracts people that are used to thinking about randomness in finance. And what he said is, he says, everybody knows if you know what value to put for the McCready ring setting, it tells you how to fly, and what setting should you use, given that the strength and position of the thermals is uncertain, and you may not have enough altitude to reach them before running into the ground. So again, he made a specific model, which I'm not telling you, and he solved the problem as he posed it, and his conclusion is basically on this picture. He says, the important thing is that your input parameter, McCready number, should depend on the distance from the goal and on your altitude. So whereas neither of the previous things permitted that. Neither McCready himself nor Edwards. So the two limiting cases here, if you fly at a small, this is a 2 is a small number, so you're flying slowly. If you fly slowly, well, you can travel a long distance. You're more likely to find a thermal before you hit the ground. On the other hand, most of the time you'll be going fairly slowly because you're being very conservative. On the other hand, if you're flying at a setting of 5, that's a very fast, aggressive setting, you will fly fast, but you have a good chance of not finding anything before you hit the ground. And the result of the output of his model is basically that you should fly aggressively at first, but then as you get lower and you haven't found anything, you should become more and more conservative. So you should slow down as you get lower. I mean, it basically agrees with common sense. So good speed if you do find a thermal, and then if you don't, you increase the range. So our model is in some sense a generalization of John Cochran's model. We wrote a paper called Optimal Soaring with Hamilton-Jacobi-Bellman Equations, and it has a couple of ingredients. We make the main thing that we do is we have to write down what our probabilistic model is. So, you know, you look out at the atmosphere, it's hugely complicated. It's a huge three-dimensional problem. The air is going up and down, there's clouds, you can see some things, you can't see them. So we make a specific model for what the randomness is. One of the ingredients has to be that if it happens that you don't find the lift, you have to put into the model what's the penalty. So you can't just say it's infinite penalty, and we loosely take this penalty from U.S. contest rules, more or less, and then the slightly technical word, what we do is that since the future is uncertain, we minimize the expectation, that's the thing that was on the Edwards graph, the expectation of the time to finish. And the technique that we use, I'm not going to show you the equation, but I'm going to explain in general how it works. It's a technique called dynamic programming, which was invented by Richard Bellman in the 1950s, the time when they were doing all kinds of optimization of everything in sight. Basically, you draw this two-dimensional plane, two coordinates here. X is the distance from where you are to the finish, which is at x equals 0. Z, I'm sorry, I'm going to call it Z, not Z, is the altitude. And so what you do is you assign, basically at each point X and Z, you try to write down this function T, capital T, which is the time that it will take you, starting at position X, distance X and height Z, to reach the finish at X equals 0. So you have boundary values for this function. Clearly, at X equals 0, the time is 0, because that's your finish. So if you're at this edge, time is 0. Down here, you have boundary values. The boundary values are the penalty that you put in explicitly. So you write down a rule that says, if I land on the ground, I will consider that being equal to, you know, such and such amount of time, which depends on distance. And then the principle that you use, the idea of dynamic programming, is you assume that on this vertical line, so at a constant value of x, you assume that you've already solved the problem for the time. So from any point on this line, you've already figured out how much time it will take you to reach the finish from that distance x and from the height on that line. Then at a particular new point here, which is x plus delta x and some height, you compute over all the choices you might make for your strategy across the distance delta x. You say the time to get from x plus delta x to, and height z to the finish is the smallest of all the possible values of the time it would take you to go the distance delta x plus the time that it would take you to get from that distance to the finish. And you can reach, because you have control over what angle you fly at, you can be at any point on that line, and so you take the smallest of all of those times. That's the idea of dynamic programming. So if you do that in proper mathematical fashion, what you get is a partial differential equation for this function T of x and z. So that's an equation that connects together the small differences, because everything is based on small differences here. So it's an equation that relates together all the small differences of this function D. And I want to point out two things. One is that in that equation, loosely speaking, the velocity, I guess it's 1 over, actually 1 over dt dx, that enters, that's the thing that goes into the MacCready calculation. It, this derivative enters into a very complicated calculation at each point. Mathematically, it goes into a complicated nonlinear function. And then the other thing I want to point out is there's an assumption in this problem, which is that this expanding everything x plus delta x in terms of x, it assumes that that expansion is valid, which is an assumption that these derivatives exist. And the problem is, as Agnes will talk about, that's not always true. And then the question is, what do you do mathematically when that's not true? So just three more pictures, I think. We do this, we compute the equation, and we compute the solution. Now, I didn't tell you what our, well, this is our stochastic model is this. So what are we looking at here? The x-axis is distance. In the bottom graph, these black things are the vertical motion of the atmosphere. So where it's pointing up, there's a lift, it goes up. Where it's pointing down, it goes down. The top graph here is the solution. The thick line is the trajectory of the glider. And in this case, in this first slide, it's computed under the assumption that you know that you can look out ahead and you can see this function perfectly. So at any particular point, you can see precisely what's ahead. And so what you can see about your trajectory is that from each height you start at, you glide all the way down, all the way down, all the way down, until you're just above the ground. You push it right to the bottom because you know when you're up here, you know that you're going to find this lift. Then you climb up just high enough so that you can reach this lift here. And this is a good, strong piece of lift. See this nice, strong piece of lift. That one you ride all the way to the top. And then you again, you take it all the way down to the bottom because you know precisely what's up ahead. The other case, sorry, the same function, it's just gray instead of black, is where you have the same function here, but your information is different. So the assumption is that at any particular point, you don't know what's ahead. You don't know anything about what's ahead. It's going to be completely random. The only way you find out what the atmosphere is going to be doing is by going there and flying through it. So again, the thick line is the trajectory of your glider, and the thing that jumps out at you is that you no longer push it all the way to the bottom. Because at this point, for example, you're in reasonably good lift. You don't know that over here there's going to be even stronger lift. So because you don't know that, you take this lift, you go up, and you glide a little bit more. And then the problem is when you reach this very strong lift, you're already about as high as you could be. So the only difference is that you don't have the information at this point. So your average speed is lower. I didn't write the average speed, but the average speed is lower. So you compute these trajectories. And they are fairly similar to what you see in the real trajectory. So again, let me point out that basically this guy stays in a fairly narrow band of height up near the top. He typically doesn't go very far down, except occasionally where he passes here a long section where there is no lift, it's all going down. He gets caught low and then he climbs back up. And then the point I want to make, I didn't write it down, but let me just say, is that these are two extreme cases. In one case, you know nothing about what's ahead of you, and in the other case, you know everything. We don't really have good mathematical techniques to handle any intermediate case. So in this case, the theory is Markov processes, and there's a well-developed machinery to deal with it. And in the other case, there's also a well-developed machinery. But if you ask about the case where you have partial information, where you can sort of see, but it might not be true, that's very hard to model mathematically. And then one more picture I'll just show you. This is the MacCready number M, which is the number you set that dial to, and here it's a function of your altitude above ground and the instantaneous lift that you're in. And basically, I don't want to emphasize it too much, but I want to say that to the extent that this function is constant as a function of L, that's the MacCready theory. And actually, our solution is that it should depend slightly on the instantaneous lift, so it's a small modification of MacCready. And then there's some strange stuff at the boundaries here, which Agnes will talk about. And then now Agnes will talk about the mathematics. You ready?
So I'm just going to focus on the tools we are using for solving this problem. I'm going to explain why this problem is challenging for mathematicians. Then I'm going to describe very briefly the tools that are available. And I present two other applications that can be solved using the same tool. So I'm going back to this picture. Maybe it's too early. Let's look at these two little graphs in the bottom. So our solution is not smooth, as Rob said. So on the left, at the bottom of this slide, you have a nice-looking solution. It's really round and smooth. It's relatively easy to compute. On the right, you have a non-smooth solution. So instead of having a round shape, it has a kink, and that's really bad. I'm going to talk more about that later. And typically, our solutions are more like this pyramid with a kink. So actually, I'm cheating here because what I should be showing here is the time to finish, but that's not very interesting for the application. So I'm showing you instead again this MacCready index, and it's not smooth. I'm not sure you can see that very easily, but it blows up at the cloud base up there, and where the free boundary is, you can see, I hope, that there is a kink. There is a theory called a theory of viscosity solution, which has been developed in the past 20 years by many researchers located in the United States, in Japan, in Europe, mainly France and Italy. And this theory is based on one principle. All the arguments are based on this principle, namely an order preserving principle. So for that glider problem, I can explain it this way. It's really obvious. The bigger the penalty is, the bigger the time to finish is going to be. So that problem satisfies an order preserving principle. So the main point is that the theory gives a meaning to the equation. So since the solution is not smooth, actually the equation doesn't hold. The equation that could be right doesn't even hold at all. So the theory provides a notion of solution for this equation. And what is great is that it turns out that this solution provided by theory is indeed the correct physical solution we're looking for. And finally, within the theory, you have tools that help you construct algorithms for computing this solution. So the algorithm has to satisfy the same order preserving properties as the equation. That's the main point for constructing a good algorithm. So if you are a mathematician or an engineer and you don't know this tool, or the researcher wasn't very specialized, then if you write your own naive algorithm, it's likely to fail. For two reasons. Either it's going to be unstable, in the sense that your solution is going to start oscillating, eventually with a really great amplitude, and it may blow up totally. Or even if it behaves nicely, it may not pick the correct solution. So it's really not obvious to construct a good algorithm for such a problem. These applications share common features with other applications that are very well known, and we can use the same tools for all these applications because they all satisfy the sort of preserving property. So Rob mentioned the examples in finance, there are other examples in economics, but I'm going to focus on frame propagation on one hand and image processing on the other hand. So what are the common features? As I said, all the preserving principle, and the equations, they are different, but they look a little bit similar in the sense that there is a storable function depending on the derivative. It's a very nonlinear function in the equation. So I'm going to present one equation, one toy model. It looks nice. It's very short. It's very compact. The one at the top. So it's called the Econol equation. And at the bottom, I'm drawing the solution to this equation. So it's really simple. You can, I'm sure if you know a little bit of calculus, you can read this equation at the top. What it says is that the magnitude of the derivative has to be constant and equal to 1. Okay? The speed has to be equal to 1, one could say. And on the interval 0, 1. And in addition, we impose some boundary condition. We impose boundary condition at the endpoints of the interval. We impose that the solution has to be zero at the endpoint. It's often the case that you have to couple your equation with boundary conditions, terminal, initial conditions, etc., in order to characterize fully the solution that you want to compute. So if you follow that white line, I'm not sure you can distinguish white from blue, actually, it's not very... If you look at that pyramid, this is the correct solution, in some sense, to this equation. Why? Well, because it has a nice interpretation. The solution of this equation is actually the distance to the boundary of the interval. It's the analog to the time that it takes to reach the finish when you fly your glider. So it's the distance to the boundary. So it's the distance either the point zero or the point one, depending on which one is closer. So now you can understand maybe that this equation holds almost everywhere, because the slope of the straight lines making the pyramid are equal to 1. The magnitude, I mean, is equal to 1. The point is, the equation does not hold at the tip of the pyramid, because there is no derivative at the tip of the pyramid. There is no tangent line at the tip of the pyramid. So one could argue, well, that's simple. Let's forget about this singular point, and the equation holds everywhere else, so that's fine. Well, actually, there is a problem. It doesn't work. Because if you do that, then you get infinitely many other solutions to this equation. So if instead of going all the way up to the tip of the pyramid, you bifurcate and take instead this blue line and go down and then up again and down, that's another solution to your equation. Right? It satisfies the proper boundary condition, which is equal to zero at the endpoint. And line segments have a slope of magnitude 1. So we are a little lost now. We have infinitely many solutions, and what we really want is to characterize the solution, the correct physical solution. So that's what the theory of viscosity solution does. It does it in the following way. If you draw any nice-looking smooth curve, the yellow curve, above the pyramid and touching the tip of the pyramid, then the equation should be satisfied, half of the equation should be satisfied for all these curves. That's how you define, you give a meaning to the equation at this particular point. You really definitely need to have an equation holding at this point. So you replace your king by a smooth curve touching from above the pyramid. And you write a definition for the solution of this equation, and you get the correct physical solution. that is the distance to the endpoints of the interval. Okay, that's what I just said. So the first application that I want to show is by Anne Beaulieu. She's at the University of Montreal, and she, you could borrow these nice pictures from her. What you can see here is a flame front propagating. So it moves from the right to the left. On the right, you have a region which is already burnt. On the left, we have a region which is not burnt yet. And you can see this very turbulent front propagating. And the equation that you have to solve, one of the equations that you have to solve for computing such a flame front, is very, very similar to the equation I've just shown. A little bit more complicated, but very similar. And so you can see three scales in this on this picture. You have this black black line, which represents the evolution of the front as a whole. That's the average speed of the front. You have the thickness of the flame front, which is very, very small. That's another scale. And in addition, you have the scale corresponding to the turbulences, or these complicated shapes. They are due to the turbulences. With no turbulence, you would just have this black line. Another pretty picture, which is maybe less easy to interpret, but nicer. That's the flame front again. And the second application has been developed by French researchers. I've worked on it at some point 10 years ago with Elisabeth Huy, which is mentioned above. And so Elisabeth Huy with Olivier Faucheras and Emmanuel Prado, they made some progress on this application recently. And what they do is they're able to reconstruct a surface from a single photograph. So let me show you the picture. So on the left, you have the picture of the face. And on the right, you have the results of their algorithm. They reconstruct this face. And again, this equation is even closer to the econal equation I was showing before. The difference with the econal equation that I was showing before is that in addition you have some data in the equation. You have the image to plug into the equation. So it looks really nice. Of course, the face doesn't look perfect. For instance, the eyes are not that great, but it's not because of the method. It's just because the information does not exist in the photograph, right? We cannot predict anything. We cannot invent anything. We are just using the information which is available. And given the information available, that's a really great result. That's basically it. We solved a problem, a nice problem coming from the real world, using sophisticated techniques that have been developed in the last 20 years. For that type of problem, we are facing two huge difficulties. The first one is we don't have a ready-to-use theorem or ready-to-use algorithm. So there are some concepts that, and some techniques that are common for all these problems. But for every specific equation, you have to design, using this concept, your own algorithm, your own theorem, etc. The second difficulty is the curse of dimensionality. So here, for the Glyer problem, we solved an equation with three spatial variables. We cannot really go beyond that. It depends a lot on the equation, so I can tell what the limit is, but it's already... We cannot, adding one variable already is really challenging. Okay, so I think that's all. Thank you.
When in a gliding contest, surely you must see the other gliders ahead and what thermals they're finding.